My name is Jake Keeler. I am part of your American Homebrewers Association Governing Committee. And to give you a little context, about 5 years ago or so, started a subcommittee, an industry subcommittee, as a part of that governing committee to help bridge the gap between the AHA and what they were doing and what the industry was doing, because I would see these, you know, sometimes we weren't on the same page or we weren't sharing information as best we could. So we created this subcommittee, and part of that was to bring some programming to the conference that dealt with industry-specific topics. And this has been sort of the center of that effort is this talk, the State of the Homebrew Industry talk. And what we're going to do is we're going to talk about some statistics and some data coming from the retailer survey, and also some other survey data that we've been collecting. So I think it's going to be pretty full of useful information, and I expect a pretty vigorous Q&A following. So I'll introduce these guys in a second here. But before I do that, antitrust guidelines for meetings. This is going to be, if you're going to any of the industry talks, these are some things that we have to follow. We cannot discuss any of the following topics: prices, pricing procedures, margins, what constitutes a fair profit level, changes in or stabilization of prices, terms of conditions of sale, pricing practices of any industry member, forecasts of price increases or decreases. So basically, we just don't want to talk about pricing at all. Specific credit terms, discounts, rebates, freight allowances, profits, profit margin of cost, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Selection, rejection, boycott, refusal to deal with, or termination of any suppliers or customers. So if a question or a discussion is kind of going in that direction, I'll probably say, all right, you know, we can't talk about that. Let's move on to a new question. Doesn't happen too often, but sometimes it does. The Governing Committee Industry Subcommittee is made up myself. I'm the chair. And then it's made up of quite a few people from the industry here. As you can see, their names and the companies that they work for. There's also input from the Governing Committee in general, and then the AHA staff as well. If you are interested in joining this subcommittee, you can talk to me. We're pretty full right now. Basically, we, you know, talk on the phone, have conference calls occasionally, shoot emails back and forth. But it's a pretty casual commitment. What is the industry subcommittee? Our committee's function was formed, as I said, back in 2010. The committee's primary goals are to foster better communication between the AHA and industry entities, as well as provide resources, assistance, and guidance to the AHA based on concerns brought forward by said members of the homebrewing industry. And I think I'd probably add to that description, we're now becoming more of a resource for our industry members, retailers, wholesalers, manufacturers as well. Kind of a quick coverage of what we did in 2014-2015. We expanded the programming for retailers in the National Homebrewers Conference. So it was formerly called an event industry workshop. It was about 3 or 4 hour thing. And we realized that, you know, big chunk of time was probably not what people preferred. So we broke it out into these individual talks. So this year, it's a bit different. You actually have industry track seminars, two this morning and then two tomorrow morning as well. Review and develop questions for the annual industry survey. Those of you who are retailers, who of you took the survey this year? Great, fantastic. The more participation that we get with that survey, the better it is. Always, you know, the more data that we get in, the better picture we're going to have. And then exploring the idea of creating an industry trade organization of some kind, perhaps with the AHA. It's something we've always talked about. I think we're kind of on the road of doing that organically. We're kind of doing that right now, more or less. So before I get started and we dig into things, I want to introduce two of my fellow speakers. Steve Parr, Assistant Director of the AHA. I think many of you know him. You've probably talked to him on the phone or emailed him. And Bart Watson, economist for the BA. So Bart's going to have some really good insights following up, taking that data and kind of breaking it down and putting a macro lens on it. So without further ado, I'll hand it over to Steve.
All right, thank you, Jake, and thank you guys all for coming out here today. As you touched on, so this presentation is largely founded by our work at the American Homebrewers Association. We're going to be looking at the 2015 Homebrew Supply Shop Survey, as well as looking at some of the previous year's data as comparison, but also looking at some of the numerous surveys that we've done of our members, just the general homebrewing population, as well as some of the non-members. Our goal here today is to touch on some of the data points that we deem to be good indicators of the health of the industry, but also to take a step back and take a larger look at what's going on and hopefully provide you guys with some insights and assumptions of things that you can act on and go back and keep on keeping those businesses healthy. But in terms of the survey, this is the sixth year that we've conducted the survey. All the individual responses are anonymous, so nothing is requested or provided that's going to tie yourself or your business to the data that is requested. Furthermore, the report that is put together, it's an aggregate of all those individual responses, and the report that we're putting out is actually only being given to those that participate going forward. So there is that added benefit and incentive to actually participate in. So taking a look at this year's survey, we had 309 responses, so a nice sample size of the industry. Shops from 48 states participated. Is anybody out there an owner or an employee of a shop from Arizona or North Dakota? Right there. I'll talk to you guys a little bit after this. 73% indicated that home beverage making supplies are their primary source of income. So that other 27% indicating that they're coming from a wide variety of backgrounds. We had hobby supply stores, beer distributors, breweries and wineries, natural food stores, gardening and hardware stores that indicated that they've started carrying home beverage making kits. And so as Jake mentioned, the seminar immediately following this one, we're going to touch on that idea a little bit more, that hybrid homebrew shop model. Have a couple representatives up here. They're going to talk about their experiences, some of the synergies that they've found with mixing homebrew into that, as well as some of the challenges they've had. So I encourage you guys to attend that. On average responses, the respondents have been open for about 9.5 years. 39% had indicated that they've been open for 3 years or less, with 5% indicating that they've been open for 1 year or less. So large chunk of those respondents having been open just within the last 2 to 3 years. First thing we took a look at was how has the number of home beer and wine retailers in your area changed over the last year? So what we found was 49%, so nearly half of retailers indicating that they saw a new shop open up in their area over the last year. So we're still seeing a number of retailers opening up across the country. That is down comparably. With that drop, we are seeing a corresponding increase in the number of retailers opening up. This isn't terribly surprising. With the growth that we've seen in homebrewing, there's also been a corresponding growth in the number of shops, a lot of shops opening up in the U.S., and I think we're going to start to see that leveling off a little bit. We do track in the Brewers Association database, just looking at the number of retailers, and I can say that in 2014, we actually added about half as many retailers as we did the year before. Next, we took a look at percentage of purchases that include malt extracts. So originally asking this question out of interest for where that dividing line is between extract and all grain brewers. Over the years, it's painted a pretty interesting trend of what's going on in the hobby right now, and that trend being a shift away from malt extract. As you can see, there's been a steady decline in the percentage of purchases that do include malt extract, a drop of nearly 12 percentage points over the last 4 years. Back in 2012, on average, 64% of purchases included malt extract. Fast forward to this most recent survey, down to about 52%. 2 years ago, we asked this question, asking retailers and looking particularly at all those respondents that indicated that at least half of their sales included malt extract, and that represented about 70% of all the responses in the survey. This year, that was about 49%. So it certainly indicates that more people are getting into all grain. That's something we are going to be touching on a little bit later. But we did go ahead and actually ask the homebrewers for their take on this. So which of the following best describes the homebrewing method that you use most often? I will take a quick sidestep. This is from some work that we did with the Sterling Rice Group. We conducted a general marketing survey, the idea being that we're going to come up with some tips and techniques that we can use to better promote the hobby of homebrewing. And actually, if you're one of our AHA member shops, we're going to be producing a report that we're going to be giving out to you guys with some of that information. What we found was that 76% of respondents indicated that all grain brewing was their preferred method of homebrewing. With extract and steeping grains being a distant second. This was a mix of AHA members as well as non-members, so I broke that out for you guys here. Even amongst the non-members, 70% indicating that all grain is their preferred method of homebrewing. Next, we took a look at beginner beer equipment kits. So over the past 12 months, have your sales have increased, decreased, or stayed the same? What we saw was 57%. So still a majority of shops seeing an increase, continuing seeing growth in beginner beer kits, but it is happening at a decreasing rate. The response is indicating a decrease has nearly quadrupled over the last 4 years. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean that fewer people are getting into the hobby. One of the things that we took into account is that there's some new brewing techniques out there, like brew in a bag or small batch brewing that certainly play a role there. It's easier for beginners to get involved with the hobby without buying those traditional beginner beer equipment kits. We also asked retailers to provide us with what that actual year-over-year change was for those beginner beer kit sales. You can see in 2013, we kind of peaked out around 23% average growth. Fast forward to this most recent year survey, 7.5%, so it has dropped down a little bit. But 7.5% is certainly not a bad number. It's just interesting to kind of see that starting to trend down a little bit. Interestingly, when we look at what makes up those respondents, it's actually the brick-and-mortar retailers that are really driving that average up. When we section out the responses from primarily online retailers, the year-over-year change in beginner beer kits is actually a negative figure from the last 12 months. So to me, that indicates that a lot of the new homebrewers that are getting involved with the hobby are actually going to their local shop to buy those beginner beer kits. Same question, looking at beginner wine kits. Nearly 60% seeing an increase, with more indicating that kind of same sales or flat sales over the last year. Average growth also trending slightly down like in beer kits, but it is happening at a higher percentage. So retailers seeing a little bit more growth within wine kits in the last year than they did with beer kits. In 2013, we conducted a survey of homebrewers. We actually had a reach of about 18,000 homebrewers nationwide, and that was a mix of AHA members as well as non-members. And one of the things we found out was 2/3 of homebrewers indicated that they'd started homebrewing within the last 8 years. More than half of those respondents indicated they'd started brewing in the time period between 2009 and when we conducted the survey in 2013. So a large contingent of today's homebrewers that just started within the last couple years. Earlier this year, when we did our work with the Sterling Rice Group, we did ask a similar question to this to try to get some more up-to-date data. What we found was that 35% of the homebrewers had started homebrewing just within the last 3 years. 80% of homebrewers had started brewing sometime within the last decade, and on average, those respondents indicated that they'd started homebrewing sometime within the last 5 to 6 years. So, again, a lot of today's homebrewers just started homebrewing within the last 5 to 10 years, a lot of growth. Next thing we took a look at was shopping behavior. What we found out was that homebrewers shop a lot. Nearly all of the respondents indicated that in person, locally, they shop at more than one shop, on average two retailers. And the majority of those responses indicated that in addition to that, they're shopping at anywhere from 2 to 3 online retailers. So in our retailer surveys, we did take a look to see how that was impacting customer spending. And interestingly, 43% of the respondents said that the individual homebrewer coming into the shop is spending more than he did in the last month or the last year. Another 43% said they saw no change. They're spending about as much as they always have. But on the flip side, those overall visits are starting to trend down a little bit. So 2012, about 11 visits a year. 2014, down to 9 visits a year. Now, 11 to 9 may not seem like a whole lot of change, but if you think every one of your customers is coming in 2 times fewer than they did in the past, that's something that you're going to see impact that bottom line. All right, for the revenue stuff. So as we've done in previous years, we break out this revenue data into different groups depending on the types of businesses, starting with all responses and then narrowing it down from there. These figures represent a change from the previous year's figures, so year-over-year data. We got a couple different data points for you, looking at the annual data for 2014 as well as 2013. And then we started to loop in the fourth quarter figures, fourth quarter since it doesn't tend to be an important time of year for retailers with homebrewers getting back into the swing of things after a long, hot summer and the holiday sales pushing on those revenue figures. But starting with that top data here, all shops, all respondents from the 2015 survey on average saw 4% growth in revenue. Next thing we did was we took a look at that 27% of respondents that indicated that home beverage making supplies was not their primary source of income, so those gardening supply stores, the breweries and wineries that are carrying homebrew kits. And just within their homebrew departments, they saw 5.3% growth. So slightly above that overall average. So, of course, when we take that average out, we're going to see that drop down. So when we're left with just primarily homebrew, down to about 2.1% in 2014. Now, where it gets really interesting is when we start looking at online. When we take the section of respondents that indicated that 70% or more of their business comes from online sales, and we take them out of that grouping, what we're left with starts to drop below zero. So negative 2.4% gross revenue over the last year, and even more so when we look at those retailers that have been around for 5 or more years. So that bottom line, homebrew retailers primarily that do less than 70% of their business online have been open for more than 5 years, on average saw about a 10% decrease in gross revenue last year. So a much different picture than what we've seen in the last couple of years. Last few surveys seen 10 to 20% growth, and I think we're starting to see that drop down a little bit. little bit more of a deeper dive into that gross revenue figures, 47% indicating that they saw 10% or more growth in 2014. 28% indicated that they saw 20% or more growth in 2014. So still quite a few retailers seeing that double-digit growth. On the flip side, you'll see that the size of respondents that make up those groupings is slightly down from the previous year, and this is actually the third straight year of declines of retailers reporting that 10% or 20% growth. 35% of responses indicated a decline in 2014, more than double than what we've seen in the previous year. And of those retailers reporting a decline, we saw an average of a 15% decrease. So a couple major takeaways from this most recent year survey. Overall revenue growth across the board, 4% for all responses. Much different picture than that 10 and 20% from the previous years. Where we are seeing growth seems to be primarily within that online segment. Also that non-traditional hybrid homebrew shop model that we're going to be touching on here in the next seminar. The majority of retailers are still seeing growth in beginner kits, but less so than in past years. Our surveys indicate that homebrewers shop quite a bit, but while we're not seeing a drop in what they're spending, we're seeing their frequency of visits slightly down. Shift towards all grain, more and more retailers are indicating that homebrewers are they're doing all grain, not as much of the extract, and those homebrewer surveys are indicating the same thing. And then lastly, continue of growth in new shops. We're still seeing about 49% of all retailers that take the survey seeing a new shop open up in their area, but it's happening less so than we did in the past. So I'm going to pass it off from here to my colleague, Bart Watson, to touch on some of the larger picture stuff.
Great. Thanks, Steve. So thanks to the AHA, too, for asking me to be here. This is a little bit new and different this year. I'm going to try to step back from the survey and look at some of the grand macro trends that are driving what I think are some of these changes. Starting with demographics of homebrewers. Demographics are the future that's already happened. Always very important to know who your customers are and how they're going to change in the future. So three things I'll pull out really fast here. excuse me. First is that obviously homebrewers are very heavily male. You see this whether it's AHA affiliated or not. Second is the age. So we can see this two ways here on generation and that age chart. But homebrewers are drawn fairly heavily from particular groups above and beyond what you would expect in the population. So particularly that 30 to 49-year-old group is really key for homebrewers. I'm going to touch again on that in a second. And then finally, geographically, pretty evenly distributed given population with a little bit of shift away from the south and toward the west. So here's this again, just broken down and with those numbers highlighted. Again, very heavily male and a big population in that 30 to 39 and 40 to 49. This is the same thing with affiliated and non-affiliated. You can see that it's pretty similar whether you're looking at AHA affiliated, which is a good indicator for the kind of more hardcore homebrewers, the ones who are doing it more often, whereas unaffiliated tend to probably be homebrewing a little bit less. And this leads me to my first kind of grand point, which is the good news, which is if 30 to 49 is the sweet spot for homebrewing, we're about to get a lot more 30 to 49-year-olds in this country. So right now we've got about 83 million, and the millennials are coming online. So by 2025, you're going to have not quite 10 million, but 7 million more people in that sweet spot range. So that's good news for the homebrewing industry. Those are the people who are the core. They've got enough money to invest in equipment. They've got time, maybe less time than they did to go out to bars, but more time to be at home. So that's good news for everybody. All right, second. This is my second big point. You can really break homebrewing when you look at the surveys into two big groups. You've got the hardcore, passionate people. Those are the people who are here this weekend. They're going to homebrew no matter what. You know, good times, bad times, they're going to fit it into their life. You've also got this second group, which this survey, this is from a survey done by Auburn University where they interviewed a whole bunch of homebrewing enthusiasts, which they call the enthusiasts. And they group them there that these are people who homebrew, but only if they have time. So these are people who are time constrained. They'll do it when they have a chance, but this isn't going to be something they're going to fit into their life no matter what. And this leads me to, I pulled this out, the enthusiast time constraint one. This leads me to the bad news. I think the thing that's mostly driving some of the declines we're seeing is that people have less time, particularly amongst your key demographic. So you can't make up data this good. This is Google searches for how to homebrew, which is probably a good indicator of beginners getting into homebrewing. And it's graphed next to white male unemployment. White males, as we just saw, are your key demographic. And not surprisingly, a lot of people were getting into homebrewing when there were a lot of white males who were unemployed and had time on their hands. And while, you know, you want consumers to have money, the fact that they're going back to work and they don't have 40 hours a week where they're just sitting around thinking about what to do is not great news for the homebrewing industry. And so I think this perfectly describes why we're seeing some of those drops in beginner kits and people not getting into homebrewing at quite the frequency. I mean, we saw that graph that Steve showed. When did you start homebrewing? That spikes when the economy is the worst. And, you know, that makes sense. Not only do you have time on your hands, but you're looking for some ways to get beer that aren't quite as expensive as picking up a Sculpin 4-pack. All right. Third point. And this is one that I don't really know which way it's trending, and I think you're going to have to understand your local market. But the third big thing that I see really driving this numbers is the overall interaction with the brewing industry. So when you look at motivations for why people are going out and homebrewing, you know, one of them is to drink better beer, to drink beers that aren't commercially available. You see some other ones here, too, that, you know, creative outlet and so on and so forth that I think are more constant. And we see this in a bunch of other surveys. Here's another one that shows the same thing. This is an AHA survey. You know, I can customize the taste to my preferences. And you can see that a lot of homebrewers don't really, you know, the flip side here, the fermented beverages I like are not commercially available. 50% of people disagreed with that, but that means 50% of people agreed with it. So one reason people are homebrewing is because they can't get that citra-hopped pale ale or whatever it is around them. And that really used to be true. Here's a map of the U.S. in 1985 with every brewery in the country on it. It's a pretty sparse map. Here's a map. This is actually not even today. This is in 2013 with a 10-mile radius around every brewery in the country. Basically, where there are people, there are breweries. So just about everyone in the country, those rings cover 75% of 21-plus adults in the U.S. So basically, where there are people, there are breweries, and there are now high-quality beers available to them. And, you know, I don't know if this is good or bad. I think at some level it's introducing people to brewing culture. But obviously, you know, you couldn't get a lot of beer before that now is locally available, fresh, and you can go down and you can get a growler of it. So that's something that's clearly going to affect the homebrewing industry in a variety of ways. And, you know, I don't think it's a purely good or a bad thing, but it's something to keep in mind as you're moving forward. All right, so just a little bit of a summary of what we've gotten so far. We've seen that number of shop openings decrease a little bit. We're seeing changes in brewing method toward more all grain, smaller batch size, which I think is consistent to the story I was telling, that we're seeing fewer people getting in, and the people who are in are a little bit more experienced, those all grain people. We're seeing changing demographics, which in general I think are good. I think you're going to get a lot more potential customers in the coming years. But because the economy has improved, which is good in a lot of ways, but bad for people's time, we're seeing some struggles in people getting into the hobby. Access to beer brewers, again, it's a mixed bag. You know, brewing culture has really been revitalized in this country, both because of homebrewing and because of the explosion in the number of breweries. But it also means you can go to the local grocery store and you have 200 choices. So people aren't brewing beer because they can't get what they want anymore. And then non-traditional homebrew retailers. So if you study the history of retailing, and my background is actually in the retailing industry. I wrote my dissertation for far too long on general retailers. You see that what's going on in homebrewing is something that's really a trend that hits every retail industry over time. And you guys are victims of your own success. You've built homebrewing up into a popular enough hobby that other retailers are interested in it now. And so, you know, what you're seeing is competition come from a lot of different places. And this is completely traditional. If you read through the literature, this has happened to every retail industry that reaches a certain size. First, the scale competitors come in. And, you know, I'm sure a lot of you are very good at doing logistics and keeping your books, but Amazon does logistics better than you. That's why they've made billions and billions of dollars. So you're going to face competition from those online channels. You also face competition from other people who say, all right, this is big enough now, let's throw it in. The convenience shoppers who are going to a general merchandise store and they see that homebrewing kit and they throw it in there instead of going to your specialized shop. So you see this competition for both sides on the scale, cost-cutting logistics side, and on the convenience side. And this is classic. You've seen this in the number of specialized retailers that used to exist in the U.S. that don't. You can count them. Every industry has gone through this. So I'm going to turn over to Jake, who's going to talk a little bit about how you combat this, because I think there are plenty of good ways still to push back against this and to compete on things that aren't scale or convenience.
All right. Thank you, Bart. So I'm just going to go over some points of, based on what we're looking at from the survey data and what, the insights that Bart has brought to light and a lot of discussions with a lot of you out there. I'm going to talk about some insights and assumptions of where things are going and some ideas of how to evolve to answer that changing landscape. Just to give some context, I've been working in the homebrew industry for roughly a little over 10 years. So I've seen this, the trend happen. And I think, years ago we kind of thought, well, at some point this double-digit growth that everybody is experiencing has got to slow down. And as Bart mentioned, this is a natural cycle. And we work in a hobby industry, and hobbies by nature, they fluctuate, right? They come into vogue, they go out of vogue. So I don't think anybody should be thinking that the sky is falling. It's things are kind of slowing down a little bit, the market's softening a bit, but no one should be, panicking by what they're seeing. This is very natural. So where is it going? Definitely think small batch brewing, brew in a bag, trend towards all grain. That's definitely what we've seen. If you look at the data with the extract sales dropping, we're not selling as much extract, not selling as many extract kits. There is a rise in small batch brewing that's 1 gallon or 3 gallon, and those are typically all grain. I've seen 1 gallon kits this Christmas. I saw them at Barnes & Noble. It was the first table I went in. There's a home kit. To Bart's point, it's a convenience thing. Other retailers are getting involved. The entrance into the hobby is not perhaps how we used to see it, which would typically be the 5 gallon starter kit plus an extract kit. You send them out the door, and then they come back a little while later, and they get a kettle, and they get this, and they get that. That dynamic is changing. I see a shift away from the do-it-yourself equipment towards higher-end equipment and gadgets. So just go out to the expo floor, and it is amazing. And to be completely frank, there's manufacturers out there I've never even heard of. And like I said, I've been around for 10 years. And it's really exciting. So you're seeing a lot more people going to the higher-end equipment. So you might have a gap between those first purchases and then going, and buying a really nice stainless steel kettle or a stainless steel fermenter. So there might be some purchasing gaps in between. They might go straight to that high-end equipment, but then maybe they don't come back, right, because they're not coming back for those frequent purchases. Ingredients, just like we see on the craft beer side, the demand for variety, quality, and items in demand due to popularity or scarcity, that is definitely something that is happening now. Home brewers are, scratching and struggling to get the hops, the same hops that the craft brewers are trying to get. Even malt is becoming, in scarce supply on the craft beer side. Thankfully, suppliers and maltsters and hop growers are answering that demand right now, but it is something that's going to impact the homebrew industry as well. But customers want variety. They want access to those same ingredients. There's less casual hobbyists, more dedicated hobbyists. So kind of like Bart was, these enthusiast hobbyists that were kind of had time on their hands and were giving it a shot, over the past 5 to 8 years. There's not as many of those people around, right? So which is a good and a bad thing, because those people can give you, sales for perhaps a year, 2 years, 3 years, but they might drop off. The customer's moving more towards a dedicated hobbyist, somebody that's going to stay in that 7-year time cycle with the hobby and perhaps longer. There's certainly a demand for education resources from shops, organizations, online sources, clubs, focus on the individual homebrewer versus club group. So that demand for resources is still there. And I think that that's an area where, the brick and mortar shop really has an upper hand. To have that face-to-face interaction. So I just wrote down some notes of what can we do with that. I mean, if I assume that these are some things that are going on and what direction the industry is going, I think there's a couple of things we can do. One, provide resources and education for customers. There's going to be a talk tomorrow about best practices in retail, and one of the things they're going to be talking about to panelists of wholesalers is talking about the importance of shops providing resources and education for their customers. You have to keep them engaged and interested in the hobby through learning and brewing better beer. So hold classes, provide print materials that they can walk away with, create videos, and work with industry partners to drive people into your store. It's not, you know, you have to give them a reason to come back, right? If they're making less purchases or they're skipping that kettle or they're buying something, you know, they've got all these choices online, give them a reason to come into the store, right? Give them an excuse to, well, I don't really need anything, but they've got this class or this demonstration going on, so I'm going to stop in on Saturday. And then they walk out with $30 in merchandise that they didn't plan on buying. The other industries have been very good at this, that have gone through the same thing. They have to get creative in getting people into the store. You can't just expect people to walk in organically. You have to drive them in there. Another thing I think that retailers can do, diversity of products. Having the equipment, ingredients, and other items on hand that appeal to a wider audience of homebrewers. I think we've all gone through this and we've all seen this where, you know, somebody comes into your shop or you've gone into a shop and, you know, you're trying to put a recipe together and then maybe a piece of equipment and they've got everything but that one thing. And if you don't have everything, you know, they're like, well, you know, maybe I'll go elsewhere, right? So having that wide range of products and making sure that you understand what your customers want in your community and you're carrying those products. So I think diversity of products is very important. And also products that reflect these trends. You know, maybe that you're not carrying as many extract kits as you used to, and you add to your malt offerings, or maybe you're carrying in some higher end equipment and not carrying some of the other stuff that's slowing in sales. And then products that keep the customers coming back. Engage the home brewing community. Social media marketing, partnering with homebrew clubs, partnering with breweries to do events. You really have to get out there and, again, you know, make sure that people know that you're there and capture those potential people that are thinking about homebrewing. You know, maybe they're at the brewery and, you know, they're having a beer and they've thought about homebrewing before. Well, maybe if you've partnered with the brewery and you have materials there about your shop, that person can pick up that pamphlet and be like, oh, there's a homebrew shop in my community. Well, that's cool. I'm going to go in there. And they're holding a class. Oh, and it's free. Well, sure, I'll go. So you really have to, we have to work harder. It's not just going to happen, you know, a few years ago, put the shop up, open the doors. Homebrewing was so popular. You know, as long as you were somewhat, people were somewhat aware of you in their community, you were going to get people into your shop. But as we see the data showing that people are coming in less frequently or they're changing the ways that they're getting into the hobby, we're going to have to get more creative and find new ways. And then lastly, cater to a more diverse customer base, and that's based on gender, ethnicity, age. As you can see, you know, 5% of the homebrewers reported in the data, whether it was through our retailer survey or it was through the other surveys that we've conducted, 95% male, 5% female. I think there are more female homebrewers than that. I just think that the data doesn't really reflect that. We at the AHA believe that's the case. But I've gone into, we've talked about this a lot. You know, you go into your average shop, it looks like a dirty hardware store. And if it looks like a dirty hardware store, it's not going to be super appealing to a wider audience. So that's something to consider. You know, are we casting a larger net? Is the retail experience or how we position what we do, is it casting a net to a larger audience? And I think if you do cast that larger net, you're going to be surprised who would come into the shop or who you could get into the hobby. So I see there's a lot of opportunity there to, you know, perhaps not focus on the white male in their 40s, but, you know, and so you can break that down in different ways, but it is a way to think about the classes that you offer, the materials that you offer, the products that you carry. Do they cater to a wider audience, or are you just talking to, you know, guys from your homebrew club, basically. So those are some insights and some ideas of how to deal with the changing landscape. At this point, we'd like to open it up. Let's see. Oh, sorry, I had forgot one last thing. More homebrewers going pro. That's probably something that you guys have experienced in your shops. I don't you know, that probably only accounts for a few thousand customers, you know, nationwide. But there is the, you know, well, you know, I think, but more to the point, it's if my buddy just opened a brewery, I'm just going to go to his tap room on Saturday. I used to brew on Saturday. Now I just go to the tap room on Saturday. So that frequency goes down. Yeah, and we've heard of that as well. So it's certainly, you know, the number of breweries and the number of homebrewers going pro and the effect that that's having on the hobby is certainly, there are pros and cons to it. There are some cons to it, but I think there's probably more pros to it because the more that people are aware of beer, the more likely they are to make that jump into the hobby. So with that, we'd like to open it up for Q&A. And if you do have questions, if you could just come to the microphone. Don't be shy. No such thing as a bad question or a stupid question.
Got a limit on them? On slide 14, you were talking about the people that shopped percentage both local and online. Did I understand you to say that they shop locally 95% and online? Does that mean 70% of their purchases are online and 90% are local or whatever?
Those percentages were accounting for the percentage of responses. So it was 95% of those homebrewers responding to the survey indicated that they shopped at two stores locally.
That one.
And then furthermore, included in that, 80% of the respondents indicated that they also shop at 2 to 3 online retailers.
Okay, so they do. It is both. Okay.
It is both.
All right. Slide 17. This growth is that's all stores, regardless of the number of years in business or anything.
These percentages are representing all responses to the survey.
Do you break it out by any way? Can you provide it in number of years in business, you know, to show, like, okay, year one I had this kind of growth, year two, year three, and time phase that over? Is that kind of data available?
This is just representing what they had in terms of growth within the previous 12 months.
Okay.
And so we weren't asking for a specific time period. So within the first 2 years of business, what did you grow in gross revenue? No, we didn't ask that.
Okay. And
but that's a good point.
Yep.
You know, if a store's only been open for a year or 2 years, their growth figures should look in, you know, they should be in the 10 to 20%.
I will point out that for these figures, when we're putting together the gross revenue figures, we do not include any retailers that indicate that they've only been open for less than 2 years, because we want to have that 2 years worth of data to compare. So everything responding here, all the retailers have been open for at least 3 years, so we have that full years worth of data to actually compare to.
Okay.
That would impact it.
That answers my question. Okay, good. All right. And I didn't see anything, and I wondered if you were considering, and this may be in one of the other segments coming or whatever, the increase, and I think it was mentioned in the on-premise brewing. Have you surveyed retailers in that area, or do you plan to with the next survey maybe?
Particularly within just specifically brew on premise?
Yeah.
We don't have plans to. We do track it just in terms of, you know, retailers in our database. From what I've heard my time in the industry is that, you know, the rate of brew on premise has, I guess, essentially slowed down within the last decade. But we aren't specifically targeting that type of retailer, no.
Okay. All right. My questions are, if you went to the map that you, wherever you showed the breweries and whatever,
yep.
There's like one within 400 miles of me or something like that. So in my area, craft brewing has really just become available. So I'm probably 3 years behind everybody else. So that's why I'm trying to go back and figure out the three-year people. Mm-hmm. And the trends you were talking about, again, this wasn't based on number of years that you've been a home brewer or anything. It's just in general. In other words, I used to do it occasionally, or now I'm an enthusiast, or I've progressed to a passionate in 1 to 3 years, 5 years, anything like that?
There's a larger set of data with more questions, so some of this stuff is extrapolated from that.
Okay.
But we definitely see, to answer that point, The data kind of suggests there's like a 7-year lifespan of a lot of homebrewers. They get into it, they do it for about 7 years, and about 7 years is when they decide to just kind of stop doing it or to continue to do it and then just make it a part of their lifestyle. So if so you get a lot of people in that, I've been doing it for 3 years. We kind of think of it as, well, there's at least 4 more years of potential out of that customer. But at that point, many people go through a lot of life changes. They get a job and they move, they have kids, they, responsibilities change, and all of a sudden their commitment and their ability to brew on the weekend changes. So, and that is shifting. It was pretty consistent with the baby boomer generation and somewhat consistent with the Gen X generation, but with the millennials, it's interesting to see where that will go. They could have a completely different life cycle, and they could have as a customer. And as Bart said, there's a lot of people entering into that, 30 to 49 year old range.
One macro stat that I considered putting in but didn't is home ownership. I'm not sure exactly where this will fall, but for me, having space to homebrew is something that's important. And the percentage of millennials who don't own their own home yet is really high. I actually think that's another indicator that's in homebrewing's favor, that you're about to see a lot of millennials, especially as the economy has improved, moving out of their parents' basements and into their own homes. But that'll be another trend to watch as the millennials come forward, because that's going to be a make-or-break group for a lot of industries, but homebrewing in particular, in the coming years.
Yep.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Randy from the Homebrew Emporium in Cambridge. We have a little homebrew shop. I'm not sure if this is much of a question, but an observation maybe you can comment on. Towards the end of the presentation side, you were talking about how homebrewers are becoming more dedicated and they want that higher-end equipment from all the new manufacturers we get to check out a little later today. And as a homebrew shop, I want to have some of that stuff in there. But what I find is that, without talking about prices or margins or anything, it's simply more expensive for me to carry those higher end gears. So even if I have one in the shop, someone might come in and they say, oh, this price is so high compared to online, you're trying to gouge me here. You get a little bit of that bad feeling, and then they go online to purchase it, mm-hmm. Maybe direct from the manufacturer, maybe from one of the online retailers. It's not much of a question, but I just wanted to make that observation. And maybe you could say something.
Every shop's going to have a different way that they approach their product mix, right? And that's every shop's challenge. Can they bring in that and have that, have the capital tied up in inventory on their, whether it's on your retail floor or it's in the back room, or do you not go that route? And, that goes into all types of factors, the frequency of your customers coming in, the demand that they're putting on you, what are they asking for versus what do you think they want? And then your footprint of your shop itself, how big is it? And every shop has those challenges. The product mix is a challenge. I think it's a particular challenge, but it's something that, in one of the other talks, we're going to be tomorrow with Jeff Grant. He's a consultant who does, kind of retail planning. And he's going to be talking about how to kind of reconfigure stores and make them more a better retail experience. Because I think a lot of times, I don't know your experience, but most of the people that got into this hobby, they weren't retailers, or that got into the industry. They weren't retailers per se. So, they don't have that sort of retail experience coming from a different industry, like where should these products go? How do you face this? Where's your POS? All those sorts of things. So there's a lot to do. There's probably more that we can do that we don't even think of. We're not even aware of. So, that might be a good talk to go to get some ideas of how to deal with that issue.
And I'll jump in and, I think that your comment echoes the slide that I put up about kind of changes in retailing generally. That specialized retailers are not going to win on price. That's just the fact. And so as a homebrew shop, you got to figure out a way to break out of that commoditization cycle. Make it not about price. Make it about other value added that you can provide. Figure out ways that you can really connect with that customer and be the expert so that they want to buy the product from you because they know that they're getting the best deal. That they're getting a something that's great. And you know, you're going to lose some customers who, if they know what they want and all they care about is price, it's not a challenge you're going to win. So you got to figure out other ways to get them in the store, add value, and make them want to buy from you, even if, you know, somebody else is 5% cheaper.
Thank you.
Hi, my name's Doug. I'm new to the business, and this past January I had the privilege of going to a unified symposium up in Sacramento, which is geared towards primarily the wine industry, the largest in North America. I do have to commend what they said about the brew industry, and talking particularly about the resources that they say that we're lacking. Every one of the workshops that I seem to go to, they were really excited about how well we in the brew industry create a story, create a connection, create something to lure the millennials into consuming our prime resources, the beer. And I was really taken aback as to how they kept lifting up and elevating the brew industry and how we're doing it right. We make tasting packets and create these ways of how to describe what you're drinking, which is important to those of us who want to try different kinds of beers. The wine industry does not have something like that. So I share that with you, that there is a lot of great things being said about what we're doing. But one thing that was apparent there, and it seems to be apparent here based on some of these things, is a demographic of the Hispanic population. An area, if we really sense we want to grow, why are we not tapping into creating resources and going into those neighborhoods where, as they gain traction or gain more awareness and maybe financial status, that's a market niche that we can certainly probably tap into, help expand. And this people demographic, they're very, very loyal. They really appreciate the small-time person, the small-time business. And so I'm just asking, is there something that is an agenda that we can begin putting forward to the Hispanic people, primarily the Spanish language, with terms of resources that will allow us as homebrewers to really begin going after that as an opportunity for us to expand our businesses?
That's a great point. Thank you for that. And it really touches on the point of, you know, whether it's a certain cultural group within your community, or it's gender, you know, appealing to female brewers, or it's a, you know, it's an age thing with millennials. There are these untapped markets that this industry has just traditionally never served well, or maybe did just by accident. You know, you just happened to be in a neighborhood and you made a connection with a group of people. So I think there's massive opportunity there. And to that point, is the AHA doing anything to reach out to those communities? Yes, we're actually, the study that Steve was talking about from Sterling Rice Group, there's a first half of it, which was this research conducted to figure out, you know, who are homebrewers, what do they want? And the second half will be developing ways to reach those for the AHA. It's for to gain membership, but also as it pertains to the industry, how can we elevate this hobby? How can we elevate the awareness to groups that have traditionally not been tapped into or talked to? And so there will be efforts from the AHA and coordination with all of you and the industry to reach out to those different communities. We have talked about, you know, an idea of something like, you know, there's targeted marketing to promote the hobby, but there's also something like a Got Milk campaign, you know, on a national level that the AHA can kind of get everybody together, rally around, and then that's something that all of you can use to drive awareness and drive people into your stores. But yes, I definitely think so.
A lot like it was in 1996 when mm-hmm. we first started seeing the trend go up. And just over the last year, demographics on Latino people has increased in my business by 20-25%. Yeah. They're not looking for the Comedo beers anymore. And, you know, they're really, really getting into the flavors. And in fact, you know, I'm watching Mexico, and some of my customers that have moved down there actually getting brew pubs going and homebrew stores going and even homebrew clubs. We have a homebrew club in Hermosillo now.
Fantastic. So,
but the industry's got to help me be able to serve them as well. The whole customs thing, especially when you're talking about yeast going across that border, it's sketchy at best. So.
Yeah. Good.
In fact, at one time I was consulting with a country club down there that was putting in a brewery, and we had to smuggle our yeast in.
We didn't hear that.
And just to touch on that real quick, you know, as the AHA, one of the primary things we try to do is provide educational resources to homebrewers. And, you know, obviously seeing that as an area for growth, what we're looking at doing is providing some of those resources, but translated into other languages. And so I know many of you as retailers use our Zymergy Introduction to Homebrewing Guide that we send out for free to shops, breaks down the brewing process and equipment and ingredients needed to get started. And so that'd be one of the first areas that we're looking at translating that into Spanish, just to make those kinds of educational resources more easily available.
We actually hired a dreamer this last year, where he was born in California, but his parents were illegal, so he got deported when he was four back to Mexico. And he saw our Help Wanted ad on our website, and he put in his resume, smart guy, bilingual. He's done a lot to help us with the Latino market, help develop it, educate. So it turned into a real asset for our company.
Very cool. The question back there?
Yeah, I have like three topics I want to bring up. But I teach classes monthly. And it seems like anymore, half of the people that come for my classes are women. But I find, especially the ones that return to become customers, are women that come as couples. So I'm kind of pushing it as a couples hobby, especially millennials are coming in for couples as classes. But one topic, I'm seeing a lot of interest in distillation in my shop. And it seems like that would be a good avenue of sales, but I don't know much about it, and regulations, et cetera. I was wondering if we can have some sort of...
Well, it is illegal to home distill.
Well, in Missouri, it is legal for the state, but federally illegal.
Yeah, so yeah. The federal law will trump that state law. Mm-hmm. It is illegal to home distill, though retailers could sell, in many states they can sell the products that you would need.
Yeah.
But there's a major hurdle there. Yeah, absolutely. We've seen that. There are efforts right now. There's a group, I think.
There is, I believe, a Home Distillers Association out there. I know many of you have probably been approached by them. But the AHA currently does not have any plans to approach the issue of the legalization of distillation at home.
Okay. And the last topic, I've discussed this with other retailers out of my area, but it seems like homebrew clubs can be a plus and a minus. Mm-hmm. I host a homebrew club every month to meet in my shop, and yet they go out and do group buys, you know, where the all-grain brewer is increasing. I'm not gaining sales for grains because of these group purchases that are out of...
The homebrew is on pro.
Yeah. Yes. And that's a good point. Maybe that phenomenon's increasing a bit now, but that has always been the case. And that's something that, you know, if a wholesaler decides to sell to a certain group of people, there's nothing we can do. That's their prerogative to do that. But I guess it goes back to, as Bart was saying, you know, if you're losing the sale based on, somebody's going to buy it in quantity someplace else or based on price. I mean, retailers deal with this with Costco or Sam's Club. It's the same phenomena, really. I'm going to go buy, 5 months worth of toilet paper over here just to save the money. So you have to give them a reason to come into the store or a value-added proposition to say, well, I'm going to go in there because I'm going to talk to so-and-so. I'm going to get some insights. They can answer my questions. And you know what? Then that starts to build that loyalty. So the next time they're like, hey, do you want to do a group buy? They're like, you know, I'm just going to go down to the shop because I want to give them the business because I believe in what they're doing.
On certain terms, they shouldn't do that.
Yeah.
Because that's rude.
I agree. It's irritating for sure.
And then the incentive is to come into your store and buy yeast and hops. I've been beat up over $3 on a bag of grain over these group buys, but they're all lined up to buy the milk of the homebrew industry, liquid yeast, one of those things where you don't make money off of it, but you don't make money if you don't have it. It's like a grocery store and milk. But they don't
seem to grasp that in order to get those hops and that yeast, the bread and butter has to sell too.
Yep.
And I think part of that's education. That's probably an area where the AHA can step in and reaching out to homebrewers and letting them know that these kinds of practices, while it saves you money, it hurts your local homebrew supply shop. And the local shop is the center of the local homebrewing community. And then, you know, I think many of them go about doing this without even realizing that.
Yep. Next question.
Yeah, the Brewers Association does an excellent job of putting together information to drive out draft beer. And have a new manual out. Are there any plans to try to do a simplified version for the homebrew community?
Sounds like a great idea.
Yeah, I'm not aware of it, but I do sit on those draft beer quality calls, so I can certainly bring it up.
Okay. Yeah, that'd be great. I wasn't going to talk about this, but she mentioned distilling. That would be a huge market, and we're all seeing that, I think. I can't speak for everyone, but we're getting a lot of questions about it. You know, there's such a huge trend right now towards whiskey and other hard liquors. I mean, it may make sense at some point to try to help with that legislation change as a group so we can gain a new customer base, because we already have a lot of those supplies that we could sell and add without adding a lot of product line, get into a whole new group of people that might be a little more excited about getting into it now.
Yeah. So I think the AHA and everyone in this room is probably going to be keeping a keen eye on where that goes. Certainly it's gained in popularity, as Steve mentioned. There's a group and association now. I don't see that going away. That's probably only going to ramp up. So currently, as Steve said, we have no plans to engage in efforts to legalize home distilling. But we'll certainly keep an eye on where that's going. And I think that's something that we can share information with our retail partners. We have time for just one more question, and there's a gentleman standing back there, so I'm going to let you have the last question.
Thanks. Going back to the topic about the cultural groups and reaching out, I just one second, I don't know where he went, but the person who talked about adding the Spanish-speaking education resources on the website and in local stores would be great, but if maybe there's folks who have no Spanish-speaking employees. So maybe you can, if you're in the larger cities, you can reach out to schools, universities that have Spanish programs. You might have Spanish translators available who are working towards internship hours. That could be an idea. Not only just Spanish, but also in larger cities like San Diego, Seattle, New York City, there is an increase in people in the deaf community who are interested in getting into homebrewing, but they have that language barrier because they are not going to hear your class. So also reaching out to your local sign language interpreting training programs would be a great avenue to get more deaf people or more access into your stores. Just a thought there. Is there any, as far as the AHA, is there any plans to increase diversity in that area as well for the deaf community?
There is not currently any plans to do so, but that's a fantastic idea. We do have, in addition to our industry subcommittee that works on putting together this track, we have a subcommittee that's located or focused just on the subject of diversity within homebrewing, and I think that's a great topic that we can bring up within that group.
Yeah. I want to thank you all for coming. This has been a good time. Obviously, we'll be around throughout the entire conference, so if you have further questions, feel free to come up to us and ask us those questions. I want to thank our speakers, Bart Watson and Steve Parr, today. Give them a hand.